Terrorist attacks in Belgium early this morning have shocked the world and sparked heightened security in the U.S. and other countries. The attacks killed at least 31 people and left scores injured. The Syria-based terrorist organization ISIS released a statement claiming responsibility for the attacks. They're the same group believed to have carried out the Paris attacks in November. Jeremy Suri is with us now to talk about these attacks and how they could affect policy in the United States. He's the Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin. Jeremy, welcome back.
Hi, Veronica.
Well, again, we'll start with these this morning's attack. As we mentioned, ISIS has claimed responsibility. So how do we know for sure if they were involved in this attack?
Well, we don't know if the very top leadership of ISIS was involved or not, but the attack shows a degree of sophistication which has the fingerprints of an organization like ISIS coordinating different activities using these kinds of simultaneous attacks. So it fits their method of operation and shows a degree of organization that leads us to believe it was at least some element of ISIS or some organization like ISIS that really was responsible.
Based on what we've heard from security officials in Belgium, this attack was not unexpected. So why did it seem to catch the country off guard?
Well, I think Belgium was on a very high state of alert, as has been reported. But part of the problem, Veronica, is that we've been on high states of alert for so long that people become desensitized to this. And also, when you're on alert, you're not sure what to look for. And we've done so much to try to make our airports secure that when something like this happens at an airport, we are still surprised because we sort of ask ourselves, well, what else could we do and how can people avoid public transportation? So we're still shocked when the expected happens because the expected is still quite horrifying.
A couple different takes about sort of the motivation here. Some people have said that this was an attack on the European Union and not necessarily just on Belgium. How do you see it?
I think that's definitely true. I think there is a small but very vocal faction of ISIS and other criminal groups that want to create an image of a clash of civilizations, of a European world that is out to destroy Muslim communities and that is prejudiced toward Muslim communities. And they want to target that Europe as symbolized by some of the European Union institutions in the same way that Al-Qaeda wanted to attack the United States as symbolized by the World Trade Center. And quite frankly, they want to spark a war between our two quote-unquote civilizations. And that's what they're trying to do. They're trying to create an anti-Muslim reaction to justify their anti-Western views.
Now, with the Paris attacks, one of the things we heard about the motive was that Paris was seen as a decadent city that maybe some in the terrorist organization were at odds with. Is this sort of an evolution of a motivation here?
Well, I think there's a general criticism from some fundamentalist groups, not only fundamentalist Muslim groups, by the way, about a decadence of Western civilization, decadence of democracy, and they associate that with materialism, with the depiction of naked bodies, all sorts of things. And so that is part of this. But we really don't think of Belgium or Brussels as the center of decadence. I think that's really stretching things a little bit. I think it's more that Brussels is seen as the center of a new Europe, a European Union, and that is seen as threatening to the kinds of fundamentalist Muslim perspectives that a small group of terrorists who do not represent Islam want to see put into place.
And what about the possibility of retaliation here as a motive? Is that something that's emerging?
Well, I think they are trying, as all terrorists do, to create fear, and they're doing a very good job of that, by the way. And in creating fear, they are trying to discourage citizens and leaders from taking actions such as the hunting down and arresting of one of the Paris bombing plotters, which happened obviously a couple of days ago. They are, in doing that, they are trying to scare us away from these law enforcement actions in the ways that any criminal group tries to intimidate witnesses and intimidate law enforcement. And again, they're doing a good job of creating fear, that's for certain.
We're talking right now with Jeremy Suri from the University of Texas, Austin, talking about the terrorist attacks in Brussels this morning. And looking specifically at the target of Brussels, Belgium has been called ground zero for ISIS networks in Europe. Can you tell us a little bit more about why that might be?
Well, at first it's surprising. Paris seems to make more sense because you have, and certainly in total number, you have far more Muslims living around Paris than you do around Brussels. And Belgium as a whole is a very small country. It's often an afterthought for Americans. In fact, many Americans can't even find it on a map. But I think the reason why Belgium has become a kind of ground zero for this kind of organization, I think it's threefold. One is that Brussels, the capital of Belgium, also serves in many ways as the headquarters for many European Union institutions. So it symbolizes Europe in the way that New York symbolizes the American financial system. Second, the country, Belgium itself, is a federalist structure loosely held together of different groups. And so law enforcement is complicated there. It's not a centralized state in the way that France is. And it doesn't have a lot of experience with anti-terrorist activities. So law enforcement has had a lot of learning to do, and that's made it an easier place for some of these groups to operate than in parts of Paris and elsewhere. And third, and perhaps most significant, Belgium is a crossroads society. It's located geographically between a lot of places, and it's a place a lot of people come through. And that makes it geographically an efficacious place to bring people together, more so than an island like Great Britain. This is a transit point, and groups organizing terror want to be in transit areas.
And apparently Belgium has also sent more foreign fighters from Europe to ISIS front lines than any other country. Does that come down to some of the factors you were just talking about there?
Well, I think it does. I think it comes down to a lot of these factors, and it comes down to the fact that Belgium has a large number, for a small country, a proportionally large number of immigrants. And at the same time, it's a society that has had trouble integrating those immigrants, as France has, into its larger structure. We should also remember that Belgium, as small as it is, has, like France, and Britain and other countries, a history of imperial activities in North Africa and in the Middle East. So a lot of this historical experience is connected to what we're seeing here.
And some experts, you were getting at this a bit, but some experts have said that Belgium has been slow to ramp up their anti-terror efforts, making them seemingly a kind of soft target. What do you make of that critique?
Well, I think there is something to that factually, and it has to do with the structure of Belgium, again, as I was referring to, and also the hope, the ideal of the European Union that Belgium represents of bringing different groups together and diminishing the militarization of society. Europe has significantly tried, at least until recently, to diminish its militarization. It was a very militarized society 100 years ago. So some of that is definitely true, but what I don't like is the implication of the way that's said. It's almost as if the Belgians are naive, and how silly of them to be slow on the anti-terrorist element. They have been, I think, fairly critical of some of the things we have done that have been in the name of anti-terrorism but have infringed upon the freedoms of individuals, the excessive surveillance, perhaps, in our society. And I think the Belgians have been trying to walk this balance between the European ideal of an open society and the need for counter-terrorism, and that's a difficult balance to walk, but we shouldn't sit in judgment and presume we've struck that balance better than they have.
What kind of international cooperation is there when there is a terrorist attack? We saw the Paris terror attacks. After that, is there any sort of mechanism in place for the countries around the world who could be affected to join together, share intelligence, and maybe share resources?
So there is a lot of intelligence sharing that happens, particularly between European countries and the United States, and Belgium is certainly part of that. The raid on the Paris bombing planner was something that was aided by external intelligence as well as internal intelligence. There's a lot of discussion among civilian leaders about these issues. So there is a lot of cooperation. That could always be improved. There always are problems of getting different systems and different bureaucracies to work together. But I think the real issue, Veronica, is a deeper one, which is how do we want to think about an open society and dealing with terrorism in today's world? Do we want to just focus on counter-terrorist measures, or are there broader things we should be doing to discourage people from going into these groups? This is criminal behavior, but criminals don't just arise out of the sky. They're made by society as well, and there has to be a balance between law enforcement and policy change on the ground, and that's, I think, the discussion we're not having yet. I fear we're much too reactive. We're not thinking about the long-term issues here.
Right. Well, those are big questions, and they're open questions, what those broader things might be. But do you want to give us a little primer on the kinds of questions we should be asking?
Well, I think, first of all, we have to ask ourselves if the hatefulness that we have heard in all of our politics, there's a rise in this kind of hatefulness, exclusionary rhetoric through Europe and the United States. We certainly have as much of it, if not more, than Europe right now, whether that's contributing to this. We have to ask about economic inequality and the absence of opportunities for people from particular backgrounds and the ways in which the inequality between the haves and the have-nots, which correlates in some cases with different ethnic groups, whether that's an issue here. We have to ask ourselves about educational institutions. None of this is to say that we should condone terrorist behavior. Terrorists are criminals, and they should be prosecuted, interdicted, and if necessary, sometimes even killed, in my view. But we also need to turn the mirror on ourselves and ask if there are things we were doing better 30 years ago than we're doing today in integrating different people into our world. Individuals become terrorists because they don't feel a stake in society. Every citizen should feel a stake in society. What more can we do along these economic, educational, and social dimensions that we're not doing?
We're talking with Jeremy Suri right now from the University of Texas Austin about the terrorist attacks in Brussels this morning. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How would you like to see the United States and the global community respond to these attacks? And do you think that what happened this morning could or should change how we talk about immigrants or Syrian refugees in this country? Call now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now about this morning's terrorist attacks in Brussels with Jeremy Suri. He's a foreign policy expert from the University of Texas Austin, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. What is your initial reaction to these attacks, and how do you think the U.S. should respond, and what would you like to see foreign policy-wise as a result of these attacks? You can call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jeremy, how has the White House responded so far? What do you make of their response?
Well, I think what the White House is trying to do is what all presidents do in these circumstances, is first try to show sympathy and empathy for those who are suffering from this horrible, horrible attack, to express outrage at the same time that people would do this, to condemn the act, but also to try to prevent us from making a rush to judgment. We need to learn more about what happened, and most importantly, we need to figure out what to do that will be most effective in response. We want to make these kinds of acts less likely to occur, and we want to find the people responsible, as the president has promised, and bring them to justice. So all of that entails not just lashing out. It entails trying to take a deep breath, gather ourselves, and figure out what to do next. And that takes time, and of course people want an immediate response, and so trying to manage the news cycle is unto itself, as you know, Veronica, a major operation.
Does it pose any particular challenges to the president in Cuba? Should he have left his post to return to Washington? Do you think it's possible to sort of straddle these two parts of what his job is as president?
Yeah. Oy vey. I mean, you know, of course, there are going to be people who say he should have rushed back from Cuba, but those are the same people who didn't want him to be in Cuba in the first place. I mean, at some level, the last thing you can do is let these horrible, despicable terrorists define our agenda. The president is in Cuba, whether you agree or not, to try to transform our relationship with this society we have not had relations with for more than 50 years. He's the first president since Dwight Eisenhower to be able to go down to Cuba. And we're trying to change Latin America. We're trying to bring positive change in our area. That's a long-term goal. And the last thing we should allow are a bunch of terrible people, a small group, to change our agenda. That would be giving in to them. So, of course, he's got to manage the issue from there. But he brings the whole White House with him. He can manage it from Cuba in the same way he can manage it from Washington. I think this is just an excuse people who don't want to see him in Cuba are making to say he should leave Cuba.
Let's go to our callers now. We've got Dan on the line in Appleton. Dan, hi.
Yeah, hi. I totally agree with the last statement that your guest made, but I take issue on a previous statement where he said we had to look in the mirror and figure out what we're doing wrong. You know, when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, we didn't wring our hands and figure out what we did wrong. We broke their will to fight. And Belgium was nice enough to let these a lot of these refugees and folks immigrate to their country. They certainly could have chosen other countries, maybe more culturally sensitive to them, to immigrate to in the Middle East. They chose to go to Belgium on their own volition. And I think we need to break the will to fight, just like we did with Japan in World War II.
Dan, thanks for the call. Jeremy, what do you say to that?
You know, I do think Dan has a point. We need to break the will to attack us among those who attack us, but doing that is more complicated than it sounds. I would remind Dan, he certainly knows this, that in our reaction to the Japanese, we did a lot of things that we now regret. We took 120,000 American citizens. I want to repeat that they were American citizens of Japanese descent, and we put them in prison. None of them, not a single one, was ever found of the interned Japanese to have done anything un-American. We held them in prison incarceration camps for 4 years. Some of their sons served in the U.S. military, like former Senator Daniel Inouye. That's a black spot on our record. We need to be careful not to do that again. What we did effectively against the Japanese in breaking their will to fight, as Dan appropriately put it, was we took time. Roosevelt did not send the U.S. Army or the U.S. Navy after Tokyo the next day or the next year or 2 years later. We took a long, deliberate strategy of breaking down Japanese abilities, first in Southeast Asia and then moving north, and of building a coalition and of making it clear to the world that we were fighting for democracy, not just fighting against Japan. And that's what we need to do. You break the will of the enemy not by just flexing your muscle and bashing them with bombs. You break the will of the enemy by building a coalition, standing up for your values, and undermining their long-term access to resources and long-term access to anger and recruits. And that's what I'm arguing. That's why we need to look in the mirror.
We're talking with Jeremy Suri right now from the University of Texas Austin about this morning's terrorist attacks in Brussels. Now, Jeremy, as you know, there is a presidential election going on right now.
I hadn't noticed, Veronica.
How does this change, how recalibrate what we're seeing from candidates and what the public is going to want to hear candidates talking about?
Well, there's a negative and a positive story to tell, I think. The negative story is the predictable, and we've already seen it today. There's a tendency when these things happen to want to try to talk tough for the sake of talking tough and to talk against immigration and even sometimes to repeat hateful words that are counterproductive in fighting terrorists but are popular among people who are legitimately angry and want to hear tough talk. So that's the negative side of this. It encourages a false toughness that's actually counterproductive, and that's what the terrorists are counting on. The positive side of this is we've been down this road before, and I think Americans all understand, I really do think all Americans understand, that fighting another Iraq war is not the way to go, and that there has to be a more sophisticated response than just using military force. We should use military force in discreet ways, but getting beyond that. And that's the positive side, and that's the opportunity. A leader who can sound empathetic, sympathetic, strong, and decisive, but also more sophisticated, and can talk to us about options as a great society beyond simply the military, has an opportunity to really galvanize people. And I hope one of the candidates will do that. I hope with her less hate and more thoughtfulness about how we shape the world.
And yet, as you said, one thing that these terrorist strikes do is they engender fear. People are fearful, even though we don't live in Europe. It's something you know can happen here because it has happened here. Isn't that going to cause a certain segment of the electorate to look for a strong, maybe more protectionist or aggressive kind of response or posturing?
Yeah, I mean, what you're asking in a sense is, will this help Trump? And maybe to some extent with some voters. But hopefully it'll warn many people against a candidate like that, because it will warn them that we've been down this road before. We said, you're with us or you're against us, right? We started a war, and boy, oh boy, I don't see a reduction in these issues since then. I don't see us any safer. So I think people who are prone to want to find a strong man to answer their problems will be more convinced, and those who are uncomfortable will be more uncomfortable and more worried about that. So it probably gives a little more impetus to the tough talker in the short run. But I think over days and weeks, I think it actually might play to both sides in a certain way.
So it sounds like you're saying this is not, at least as you see it so far, a game changer.
No, I don't think it's a game changer. I think it becomes a game changer perhaps when it's on American soil. But even then, I'm not sure. But I don't think this is a game changer, and I think it actually poses a risk that the candidates who see this as a game changer could overplay their hand. I really think that the American public does not want to refight the Iraq war or anything that looks like that again.
And
good for the American people for thinking that.
What about Bernie Sanders, who polls well among Democrats in Wisconsin? Foreign policy not his strong suit. Does it hurt him?
No, because he's weak on foreign policy for all kinds of reasons, many of which you've articulated. But on this issue, his whole point is that our military activities that we've spent billions and billions of dollars on have not dealt with this problem, and that we must approach it in a different way. And this would seem to reinforce that message as well. You can't claim the United States has not spent a lot of money. You can't claim we haven't used a lot of force. So if we've used a lot of force and we've spent a lot of money and we haven't made the problem better, Bernie Sanders argues, maybe we should take a different approach. Maybe we don't need someone who's part of the foreign policy establishment. So his anti-establishment argument, I think, does, with people who are inclined to believe that already, I think it does carry more weight with them.
Jeremy, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Veronica.
That was Jeremy Suri, Mack Brown Distinguished Chair for Leadership in Global Affairs and Professor of History and Public Affairs at the University of Texas, Austin, joining us to talk about this morning's terrorist attack in Brussels.